I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
Goth, post-punk, shoegaze, avant-garde metal. These aren't the genres of music you hear on the radio every day, but nonetheless, they have a devoted cult following among music aficionados. On this edition of the program, we talk to a multi-talented musician who's dabbled in all of those genres. Joshua Schron has been a key player in such musical projects as the post-punk revival band Blacklist, the experimental metal outfit Vara, and the much-lauded Azar Swan alongside Zora Atosh. He's also had a rather interesting life trajectory outside of his musical endeavors. For one thing, he grew up in an evangelical Christian household before becoming a militant humanist with a keen interest in intellectual and literary figures like the Russian revolutionary Viktor Serge, the Slovenian philosopher Slavoj Žižek, the postmodern novelist Don DeLillo, and many, many others. Additionally, Joshua, while in the aforementioned band Blacklist, took up studies at New York City's much-noted The New School, where he struck up a friendship with the acerbic new atheist provocateur Christopher Hitchens in the later years of Hitchens' life. In other words, Joshua has many intriguing thoughts and experiences to share about a wide range of topics, from the evangelical mindset to the influential Brooklyn-based Weird Records music scene on this edition of Parallax Views. Even if you're not a music aficionado, I think you'll find this discussion rather interesting. And yes, we do talk about Christopher Hitchens. With all that being said, why don't we dive right into the conversation with Joshua Schron of Blacklist, Vara, and Azar Swan. Welcome to Parallax Views, Joshua Schron.
Thank you.
So Joshua, you're a really interesting sort of renaissance man. You've done stuff in music, specifically with the post-punk revival, and you've also got into a sort of political and cultural commentary. You went to the New School and had some experiences with Christopher Hitchens. But I'm just curious, what's your sort of background? I read that you were from Des Moines, Iowa originally. How does a kid from Des Moines get into sort of the post-punk scene and Christopher Hitchens and New Atheism?
Well, I was born in Iowa, but I moved to southwestern Virginia when I was about five, and that's where I grew up. And it's a small, railroad town in the you know, it's not super small. It's not huge, you know. But you know, it's pretty conservative for the most part, and you know, it's a little boring. I was, you know, in private Christian school when I was very young. My parents kind of went through an interesting arc, I guess. You know, they were kind of like a little more into counterculture and stuff in the 70s, and then they got really, they had a family like right around the time of the, like, you know, strong like surge of the religious right and Reagan times, you know, like heavy metal, satanic panic, all this kind of stuff. So that was all like severely off limits for me. And yeah, I guess, I mean, somewhere between, I think like kind of darker dramatic music helped make the sort of dullness of the landscape a little bit more bearable. and I guess, you know, in terms of like religion and things like that, it really stems all for me from that background, kind of like initially in extreme conservative evangelicalism, and then and then it was like Southern Baptist till I was like, you know, in my teens. And so, you know, then I will say, you know, my parents' politics were interesting because there's also this like really strong strain of like kind of anti-colonialist kind of you know, pacifism. So I was also, at the same time, I was raised with this, you know, kind of abortion is evil, kind of heavy metal, Kiss is the devil stuff. You know, my mom was also like, you know, taking us to like Cherokee reservations and lecturing us about like the evils of like, you know, European colonialism. So there was also this kind of strain, I guess, of like left politics that I gravitated towards as I got older. And yeah, I mean, I think all those things just kind of started tying themselves together as I became an adult.
Well, yeah, I know your music's been described as militantly humanistic, and as you said, you sort of grew up with a background amongst, you know, an evangelical background. Could you elaborate on that a bit? Like, what is growing up in that sort of evangelical background like? I mean, I hope that's not too personal of a question.
No, not at all. I mean, I think especially for me, with as tarred as the reputation of like current, you know, militant atheism has become, it's helpful to get into this kind of background. You know, for instance, one of the people I actually relate to a ton when she talks about it is Megan Phelps Roper, I think is her name now, like from the Fred, you know, from Westboro.
And some
of the conversation.
I was going to say the Westboro Baptist Church, Fred Phelps' daughter. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I wasn't raised in anything like that, but she really kind of goes, she kind of explains the mindset really well, and kind of from the inside, like, this is how these people think, this is how I was raised to think. And it, you know, for all the crazy my background wasn't, it's still very similar. It's like I was never coached by my parents to be homophobic, you know what I'm saying? I was in church service with them one day during the sermon, and the pastor was talking about homosexuality, and they took me out because, you know, they thought it was inappropriate for somebody my age. And I kept on asking, I was like, why, what does this mean? And so they describe, you know, very kind of succinctly, they describe like male, you know, anal sex to me. And I couldn't even tell you how old I was, maybe 7 or 8. I'm just sort of like revolted. I'm like, that's you know, how could you ever, you know, poop comes out of there, you know? And then from there, I do the research on my own, and I read that it says that, you know, gays are to be put to death. And from there, I'm like, I'm on board. You know what I mean? And it's horrifying to think back to, but you know, I mean, it's where I start to clash, you know, and I often clash the most with kind of like secular liberals who think that, you know, all this militance is misplaced and we should be nice about, like, you know, how people make sense of the world. I'm like, no, you don't understand what this does to your brain. You know what I mean? So, it's experiences like that. I was in school during the Cold War, and I was probably like second or third grade, at this particular Christian school. And we were, you know, having explained to us that, you know, there were countries where you weren't allowed to worship God. Right. So as part of this little unit, one morning they had these men come in with like toy guns. And this is during a time when like toy guns look like real guns. They didn't have to be neon orange yet, you know, and to take us out into the, march us out into the parking lot. And they asked a kid, like, you know, will you deny Christ? I mean, this is crazy abuse, but nobody told their parents, nobody, this didn't go to the news. This was just like how we were taught about politics, you know? So yeah, I mean, those are formative experiences.
Yeah. There's a real, you know, cult like indoctrination aspect to, a lot of sort of the, you know, fire and brimstone sort of side of Christianity that I think people overlook at times. I mean, we just had that Washington state representative who wrote a manifesto saying, if they do not yield, kill all Mills. You know, if they don't accept Christ as their Lord and Savior. I don't think people realize, like, just how militant a lot of these sort of fire and brimstone types are.
Well, right. It's like, it's this thing. It's this almost like narcissistic thing of, if I only understand religion as the nice parts and as a metaphor, then like that must be how most people understand it. And anybody else who doesn't understand it that way is, you know, just a cynical person using religion for their own ends. And I think that analysis is kind of what my experience and like kind of the Megan Phelps Roper experience, you know, it's like you don't understand that this is really what people believe because this is really what it says. And in the end, it comes down to literalism. People are just like, this is the inerrant word of God. And, you know, here's how I'm going to enact that in the modern world. And yeah, that's a reality. And I think as far as I'm concerned, especially in the last 2 years, as things have gotten worse and worse, it's only been borne out in the alliance of, like, you know, evangelical Christianity with like Trumpism and abroad, you know, the Orthodox Church with Putin's Russia. You know, this is an old story.
Yeah, it gets...
But one that's not over, you know?
No, I don't think it's over at all. You know, what's interesting to me is, so you grow up in this background, what sort of ends up being the catalyst for you going to a more atheistic position on things?
Well, it actually took a long time. I mean, I think, you know, to hear me talk about my background, people would assume that, you know, by the time I was a teenager, I was mad at God and all this kind of stuff. But I was actually really, really, my mom was a kind of philosophically minded person, even though she wasn't, you know, steeped in philosophy proper. And we would have a lot of long conversations. And I was always really interested in, you know, increasingly sophisticated intellectual explanations for, you know, divinity or God. And I followed that, you know, into a lot of corners as I grew up, everything from, like, you know, the old quantum physics proves, you know, this magic of the universe to I can't even remember half of them. but that was something I really liked. I really liked the kind of Fritjof Capra. There was a film made after a book that he had written called Mindwalk, I think, with Liv Ullmann. And just like one of those conversational films where, you know, a scientist and a poet and all these three people, I forget their professions, are kind of like discussing to the meaning of life as they walk around an exotic, you know, French location. The name of it is escaping me right now. It's the church that is on an island kind of, and it flit, you know, at different times of the tide you can go across. So I was actually really fascinated by those kinds of things until I got older. And I think, but it got hung up on something really simple, I guess, which was just that, like, if supernatural things don't happen now, why did they ever happen? You know, why do I believe that they ever happened? It wasn't really any breakthrough of a moment until except just sort of like reaching a point where I was like, you know, I don't think that stuff ever happened. And if I don't think that stuff ever happened, then none of it's, you know, I don't have to investigate its truth anymore. You know what I mean? Like, I think I run into a lot of debates with like secular, but spiritual, you know, kind of respectful of religion people where, or maybe they're liberal religionists, you know, where they're like, oh, well, you know, I don't take any of this literally, but you know, it's still true to me. And that's always a really weird claim because I'm like, well, if it's none of it's true, then none of it's, you know, like why do you still need to explain the universe in terms of this, you know, this book, this figure, these figures, you know what I mean? So for me, once that was gone, like I just didn't have a use for it anymore.
Yeah. It's almost like in a way, I think you're almost saying, and you can correct me if I'm wrong with this, but it's almost like, in a way, the biblical literalists, you think they're maybe more honest in a way than the sort of secular but spiritual or sort of liberal religionistas.
Precisely. I mean, I do think that. I mean, I get into that a lot, even sometimes in current political debates. Like, I live in southern Louisiana now. I'm in New Orleans, but I was married to a woman whose family was, central Louisiana proper, you know, southern evangelicals. And I've been around them for the last 4 years. When we're having these debates online about like women's rights, reproductive rights, and how, you know, all these people just don't care about women. I'm like, no, if you frame it that way, it's a non-starter because they care. They believe firmly that there's a soul in a fetus that God put there that you will end if you end a pregnancy. And if you don't have that conversation, if you want to sort of be hands off about that aspect of the conversation, then you yelling at them that they don't care about women is just going to be like, they're just going to be like, of course I care about women. You know, I'm a woman, fuck you, you know? I think it has some pretty bad repercussions as far as how we fail to sort of tackle where our politics are right now.
Well, I think too, the other thing is, I think these evangelicals are playing off different definitions than secular people. So, for instance, sure, with the caring about women thing, I mean, to them, they think, well, yeah, I do care about women. That's why we have to control their bodies, because, you know, they don't know how to do things, or it's driven by this like sort of benevolent sexism where they think they know better than the woman herself, but they still justify that in their mind as caring for women.
Sure. And I think, I think there's a lot of different permutations of that. I think there's also a thing where you have a kind of like code of sexual morality, and all the, you know, women are sort of like, you know, sort of the same sort of anger at somebody who, like, if you've been standing in line, somebody who cuts in the line, they're like, it's like, no, we've done all the things we were supposed to do. You don't get to go have your fun, you know? I think that kind of motivates a lot of this kind of like slut shaming, moralism around issues like that.
Well, I want to move into your music, but I did have one more question on the sort of religious stuff, and maybe we can go back to it later in the interview. So in evangelical communities, I've always wondered, is the sort of the stuff like Left Behind and the whole rapture stuff, is that like actually as prevalent as people tend to think it is?
I couldn't speak for today. It was huge when I was young, and my parents were really into it. And it probably had a huge impact on me, like on my sort of young psyche, partially because Revelation was the only cool, fun, crazy, like, you know, it was like a fantasy novel at the end with all these monsters and demons and stuff. But that, Hal Lindsey was one of the big writers that was, you know,
the late great
popular.
Planet Earth.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I got a lot of that sort of Armageddon fantasy pumped into me when I was young. And I don't know how big of a deal it is now. I almost would tend to speculate that it's far less of a big deal because of like polarization and the left sort of now having taken on this environmental apocalypticism, which I, you know, entirely share. Maybe it's an easy match given my upbringing, but like, or an easy through line, but I don't know. I mean, I think there's a lot more like, at least what I absorb is a lot more like, if we don't stop the liberals, you know, they're going to destroy our way of life sort of thing. Like, and much less like God is going to be here tomorrow kind of stuff. That's what I perceive at least. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's sort of a tie between those two things, though. The whole liberals are going to destroy our way of life and the whole Left Behind stuff. I remember in the, I think it was in the aughts, there was a Left Behind video game that came out. On PC, where the whole point of the game was you had to go around killing non-believers. You know, there is a real, like,
whoa,
sort
wow.
of... Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No, I just said, wow, I have never heard of that. That's amazing. It's not shocking, but still amazing.
Yeah, it's all driven by this sort of, like, fear of anyone that is, like, you know, the other, so to speak.
Right, and I think, like, having been exposed to it at the age I was, and looking back on some of the behaviors that really still revolt me in people and in you know, political and religious sects, it's like, it's at that, you know, going through this period of growth, you know, where I was learning what it meant to be social and, you know, learning about social in-grouping and social out-grouping. And there's this tremendous anxiety, you know, I'm a young boy. I'm like trying to make friends, you know, I'm the weirdo on the block because, like, you know, the other kids go to public school and this kind of stuff. So there's I have a pretty vivid memory of how, you know, proclamations, that, you know, the Bible says these people are, you know, terrible abominations, whatever, whoever they might be, is really, it feeds something that you need when you have those anxieties, you know?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think the crossover between a lot of the musical stuff you do, which, like I said, it's post-punk revival. I guess some people would sort of try to pigeonhole it in the goth scene is, you know, a lot of your imagery in some of your bands sort of dabbles with a, you know, Satanism or satanic imagery. What sort of drew you to that sort of use of imagery? I assume you're not a Satanist in the sense that people would think of it, or even if you self-identify as that.
Well, for me, I think that that element came into play after Blacklist. I grew up like, you know, I was a metal kid first. I was like learning to play guitar to like, you know, Death and Metallica and things like that. So, you know, I always kind of like dug that a little bit, but it wasn't something I delved thing. I mean, those, the kind of taboos that I had in my head from being very young, still kind of stuck with me as I became more independent, you know? So even if I'd be like, yeah, you know, I'm going to go listen to death metal, I wouldn't listen to like, you know, if I thought a band was like super, you know, satanic, I was still, you know, it's not like I completely let go of the cosmology, you know, or the metaphysics of demons and gods and devils yet. So, and even Blacklist, we were fans of like both, you know, the Chameleons and the Compton Angels and the Sound, you know, all the bands that we always used to cite. And then, but we were, you know, also huge fans of Priest and Maiden and Ozzy and, you know, kind of like classic 80s metal, stuff like that. So it was always in the backdrop of Blacklist, whereas the lyrics for Blacklist were very didactic, anti-fascist manifesto and sort of stuff. But I think I kind of not only said as much as I could say with that record, I kind of hit a wall with writing that way and became more interested in poetics as opposed to didactics, I guess. And that's when I started paying a little bit more attention to black metal, because I was stumbling across, there was a lot of this sort of French goth crossover, you know, with black metal, that intrigued me. And then I started paying more attention and it became an influence, you know, and I started, because so many of those bands are, you know, super satanic or into various permutations of Satanism. I read the Satanic Bible. I read, you know, very, you know, whatever I could find. And, you know, even some of the interviews, you know, bands are getting asked, or, you know, what's your Satanism like, you know? but, you know, and in the course of that, I guess I kind of became, because, you know, growing up in the church the way I did, I was like mostly fascinated by Satan, you know, like I wasn't like reading my parents, you know, books about the evils of rock and roll thinking like, I hate this stuff. I'm like, I want to look through it because it's like, looks cool to me. You know what I mean? I wasn't going to the harvest parties where they were telling us Halloween was an evil druidic, you know, tradition of human sacrifice, thinking like, oh, this is terrible, I don't want anything to do with this. I was like, man, this is rad. You know, like I was always into it, you know? So I think, and I think for, on a very personal level, and this is something I sometimes get into with major black metal fans, you know, who are bored with all the Satanism and think it's all stupid. It's like, for me, it became this like psychological exercise of like reminding myself that the fear that I grew up with wasn't afraid of it anymore. Not only that, but that, you know, a lot of the, you know, I always go to the Abraham and Isaac example, but, you know, if it's God telling you to slaughter your child and Satan telling you, or and Satan's influence telling you not to, Satan's the good guy. You know what I mean? Satan's the moral one. So I think that's really why I gravitate towards it. That those are the two main reasons. Part of it personal and part of it poetic.
Yeah, I think it's interesting too, because you know, if you look at certain biblical stories from an angle, you can get a very different meaning out of them. For instance, the story of the Garden of Eden. You know, it's very easy to see the serpent as a liberatory figure from a certain perspective.
Yes. And that's almost how, I mean, that's, for me, I think you get into these debates, you know, especially around the secular humanist community, which I kind of orbited around a little bit, but really disliked, you know, and it was hard to explain why. And I understand why a lot of people don't like it. It's like a lot of the principles being espoused are things that I agree with, but like as a community, it's got a really shitty tone of voice and a really bad aesthetic. You know what I mean? And so I think you get into what I was saying, you get into debates about like, well, you know, what about the power of myth to sublimate meaning in a way that like contemporary sort of like rationality doesn't have the power to do. And, you know, so you get into this territory where you're like, well, yes, that is extremely powerful. And it's hard to just create your own, you know, myths in the present that have that same power. But if you have these time-honored myths that have characters in them that represent your principles, then to invert them is, to me, like, seems pretty legit, you know? And I think there's a lot of sort of almost just basic like aesthetic elite, you know, and social elitism that comes with like the condescension to the culture, you know, and the kinds of people that have gravitated towards, say, you know, Satanism and black metal and, you know, whatever stuff like that. I get it. I know the kind of like dorks that, you know, the people who hate that stuff don't want to be associated with, but I'm not entirely convinced that it's a stupid, you know, useless errand, you know?
Well, I mean, obviously the image of Satan is very powerful. I've always found it interesting that, you know, it seems like evangelical Christians or the Christian right in America, I feel like they're almost more obsessed with the image of Satan than they are with the image of God. That's what's fascinating about it, because it is a very powerful, you know, sort of mythology.
Right, and I think I couldn't give you the exact statistic, but Satan is actually mentioned a remarkably small number of times in the Bible. It doesn't figure in that much. It's really an extrapolation from, you know, of theologists and, you know, clergy and the religious believers themselves. It's not really a strong undercurrent of the text.
He also kills a lot less people in the text than God.
There's that.
Well, moving into your music a little bit more in depth, I know you said you started out with a sort of, you know, metal. Were you like a striper guy? Is that how you got into the metal scene? You know, the Christian metal stuff? Or was it just that you were looking at the sort of edgy taboo stuff?
No, I mean, I slid in like stealthily. There were certain bands and artists from my parents, you know, whatever, I don't want to, you know, 20s or late teens that they still were down with, you know. And like, I remember my dad was still always cool with Eric Clapton. He was a big Clapton fan in the old, you know, he was also a big Sabbath fan, but like, you know, my dad would never be walking, you know, tell me how cool he thought Black Sabbath was when I was younger. Whenever an Aerosmith song would come on the radio, my dad would always go, Joe Perry's such a good guitar player. You know, he's really into guitar players, really into Jeff Beck and people like that. So, and a huge Pink Floyd fan. And, the two records that came into my household that probably, you know, had a huge impact on, and you can probably hear it in what I do, everything I do to some degree, but it was U2's The Unforgettable Fire and Pink Floyd Momentary Lapse of Reason. He brought those cassettes back from a work trip, and I really, you know, I loved that kind of like large production synths, you know, like gated snares, epic guitar solo, you know. It was like, that was kind of the beginning. But I mean, when I started to try to, you know, be independent and get into some of the music that I wanted to get into, because I didn't really think that much Christian music was cool. there were a few bands that I liked growing up, but I kind of genuinely always thought it was like less good than secular music. So I'd be like, oh, I'm going to bring home an Eric Clapton record. I probably won't get in trouble for that. And then I didn't. I'm going to bring home an Aerosmith record. I probably won't get in trouble for that, et cetera, et cetera. And then you kind of, you know, that is the slippery slope that like some parents fear that it will be. And before you know it, you know, it's like, screw it, Mom, listen to Metallica and Megadeth now, you know, like, sorry, nothing you can do about it. And they usually never fussed unless something sounded extremely, unless they caught a lyric that really bothered them or, you know, something sounded extremely evil. I don't know. They, or was overtly satanic, you know, they never really gave me guff.
Well, then how do you sort of transition into post-punk? Because I think your bands are mostly known within, you know, the sort of, like I said, post-punk revival. And it's always interesting to me with post-punk, because everyone has a different band that got them into it. Like some people are Joy Division people. I myself am a Killing Joke person. How did you get into the whole post-punk phase?
Well, the music that like really like blew the world open for me in high school was, and it was funny, some political Twitter person yesterday was like, what's the record that, you know, changed your whole path? And I was like, well, there are probably four: Nine Inch Nails, Pretty Hate Machine, Front 242, Up Evil, Too Dark Park by Skinny Puppy, and the Wax Tracks Black Box, all of which I probably got within, you know, a few months of each other. So that was like the, you know, the ground shaking. And from there, I was like a hardcore industrial person, you know, for several years. And when I went away to school, you know, people would joke with me. They're like, oh, you're gonna be goth before you know it. I was like, fuck goth, you know. I just like heavy synthesizers, you know. And I guess it was the Sisters of Mercy, probably. Like, I mean, like First and Last and Always. Somebody left a tape in my dorm room, and I was kind of the biggest one, I think. And still, I mean, I still one of my favorite bands. I stumbled across a 1984 show with like mostly songs from the EPs, you know, and a couple of songs that ended up on First and Last and Always, but that was the main one.
Yeah, Sisters of Mercy is a band that I got turned on to in my teenage years as well. You know, just I loved seeing them live. They had the drum machine, which they call Avalanche, you know, in reference to Leonard Cohen,
right,
where they also get the name for the band. They're just a really incredible band. They're also interesting because they also cross over into politics in a lot of ways, too. The lead singer describes himself as an anarcho-syndicalist.
Right, right. Yeah, no, that was a huge influence on me and on Blacklist, really, because it was funny. I was looking up a quote to tell a friend the other day from an old review of Blacklist record. In The Quietest, which is one of my favorite, still to this day, one of my very favorite music magazines of all time. And it's not a terrible review, but there's a few digs in there at, you know, the originality and sort of that person's perception of my own politics and, you know, political seriousness. But the reason I bring that up, and I think it's funny, is because the whole point was, for me, was like that music that sounds this way has only ever been like witty, deftly smart political once. You know what I mean? And that's the Sisters of Mercy. And very few people would, like, you know, think of them as a political band. But, I mean, even in the doomy EP stuff, you know, there's all these sort of, like, snarks about corporations and war, you know. I was like, yeah, I mean, at a strictly formal musical level, there were a lot of callbacks to, you know, 80s post-punk. But for me, the exciting thing and the original thing about it was to be a band that could be like sort of like smart sloganeering Manic Street Preachers style, but do it kind of like the way the Sisters did with darker music, you know? So.
Well, it brings me to, you know, the album that, you know, it's very much beloved by a lot of people that are into the post-punk revival, and I'm talking about Blacklist's album, Midnight of the Century. How did Midnight of the Century sort of come together, and what were you trying to accomplish with it?
Well, it came about, I started gravitating around the weird scene before Weird was a party in Manhattan, before it was a record label. It was just Peter Schoolworth, the main Mama Weird, as we sometimes call him, and Glenn, who was the drummer, who I found out about Weird from Glenn, because he had just started drumming with me and Ryan. And he was like, oh, you guys should come to Weird. And at that time, Ryan and I had kind of gotten together with, like, because Ryan and I had initially got together because we were into this kind of thing of, like, metal and post-punk. You know, we, like, loved the Sisters, loved Maiden, and, you know, kind of wanted to do something that was, like, post-punk. But, you know, at that time, post-punk was sort of, like, about people who were being influenced by those records at the time were kind of on the indie rock end of the spectrum, like Interpol being the darkest. But I mean, if you go back, and I was talking to a friend the other day, I was like, what do you call the Weathermen and French Kicks and, you know, these kinds of bands? I was like, I guess it was like post-punk inflected indie rock or something like that, you know? But for us, we kind of hated indie aesthetics for the most part, and we wanted it to sound like Thunder. You know what I mean? So, so we met Glenn, and Glenn was one of the regular DJs at Weird when it was still a Southside Lounge. And those guys were essentially kind of plucking rare cold wave and minimal synth classics off of eBay, either before they were known or before they were mega expensive. Some of them actually were mega expensive by then, but you know, for me, it was this whole world. I had gotten really, because, you know, in college I got into, like, you know, it, high school was industrial, college I got into goth, and then, like, I got bored of it, and I got into, like, you know, kind of the Britpop, darker, you know, Britpop that a lot of goths like Placebo and Suede. And I was really into the Manics because that was the soundtrack to my, like, you know, hardcore left-wing political awakening. You know, I had my stacks of Marx, you know, and I would be listening to the Holy Bible when I was driving around. But, so I was done listening to Susie and the Banshees and Echo and the Bunnymen, and as great as those bands are, is like, I've listened to them for years and years and years, but it was like this new lease on this music that I'd loved for so long. And it wasn't exactly the same, you know, cause so many of the bands that were really popular and accessible when I was getting into it were all from the UK and, you know, some Americans, but it was largely a British music phenomenon. So to be hearing all this music from France, Belgium, Germany, Poland, you know, it was Italy. It was kind of a revelation, and I loved it. And right around that time, I picked up Comstat Angels box set. An old friend of mine in Virginia had played the Comstat Angels for me at a party once, and I absolutely lost my shit, you know, and it was impossible to find. So basically that confluence of events, sort of being introduced to all this, you know, great unknown European cold wave and minimal synth, and then getting hold of that Comsats box set, was what gave me the fire to want to do what we ended up doing in Blacklist.
Yeah, well, the other aspect of that debut album, Midnight of the Century, is just the way it incorporates a lot of intellectual and philosophical pursuits. You know, I know you have a song in there that's inspired by Orwell's homage to Catalonia. You have references to Slavoj Žižek. And, of course, I believe the title is a political reference, is it not?
Yeah, it's a Victor Serge's novel, Midnight in the Century. It was
right,
called
the famous anarchist activist, yeah.
Yeah, and that was kind of, I guess, to me, it tied together. Actually only read Comrade Tuliev by Serge, but I knew what Midnight in the Century was about. And that was a huge theme for me in the whole, obviously, Homage Catalonia has similar themes of this kind of like dark machinations of betrayal, you know, of the left by the left, which, you know, can frustrate people when I talk about it. It definitely did for me. I think when we tried to, because also right around the same time, you know, at the same time I'm in school and I'm like on social media and I'm like, you know, railing about this and that, and, you know, definitely much worse at using social media than I am now, even though I still characterize my usage as unhealthy, addictive, you know, useless. But yeah, that's where the title came from.
Yeah, and like I said, it's a really interesting album because you can listen to it and just enjoy the music, but you can also listen to it as a political album.
Yeah, and that was always a fascination for me too, and a goal was, you know, I would say that it's part of the reason that it didn't land with certain people, especially, you know, music journalists, because I don't think that they expected music that was kind of that bombastic to have the subtext that it did. And I would make a concerted effort to make most of the lyrics subtle, you know what I mean? Like, there are ways of saying things and describing things and referring to concepts that weren't sort of screaming out like, I read books, you know what I mean? because I don't think that works very well in pop songs. I don't really like it when people do that for the most part. I mean, it's very, I know that sounds absurd as somebody who's like just moments ago trumpeted their love for the Manic Street Preachers, but even with them, it was like, that's a quirk about them. It's like hearing him try to fit certain phrases into the song is like, it's weird sounding. And it becomes a thing that you like about them, like you like the way a certain singer sings flat or something like that. But for the most part, I wanted to have these songs that like had this, like, you could unfold, you know, these multiple valences below if you wanted to, but you weren't required to in order to enjoy it, you know. It wasn't like you're only going to dig this if you've read this, you know. So
yeah, it works on multiple levels.
Right, yeah. And that definitely came from, like, I think that came as a natural outgrowth of being, like, coming right off of, like, I was, like, really into Lacan before that. And, you know, Lacan's always, you know, even people, I think, have made the point that the French is so poetic because it's so few words, so words have so many valences. You know, and when you're steeped in this in French theory, and this particularly this French theorist who's talking about the slipperiness of those, you know, the valences, you almost instinctually like start playing with that, or at least I did. Because I was like, oh, there's a way to sort of like communicate this concept about nationalism without using this jargon, you know what I mean? And then when you do that, you end up at the end of it, if you do that for a whole lyric, you look back over it and you can read it in all these different ways, even as the person who wrote it. And that even happened to me recently with the Vara record, the new Vara record that we just wrote. I wrote almost all those lyrics with like civilizational and ecological collapse in mind, but I still write like that. And then when I went back in and read them, I was like, a lot of these songs read like the end of a relationship. You wouldn't know the difference between what, you know, except maybe a few key words or phrases, that you wouldn't know whether this is about the end of the world or the end of a marriage, you know? And I think that's, I like that territory, even if it doesn't, sort of, I guess I sometimes feel like it doesn't, sort of hit people of, you know, because people are listening to everything super quickly, writers, listeners, you know, if it doesn't just immediately jump out, oh, this is a very sophisticated concept, or, oh, this is really beautifully emotional. Like if you're working at that level of depth, I hope for, you know, I think it passes a lot of people over. And I don't mean that condescendingly. I just think that's where I think it's where a lot of us are in terms of like how much energy we give any given song in our daily lives. Cause there's so much music, you know, there's a lot to take in, and people don't usually sit with one record for 3 or 6 months. Like, you know, like I remember doing when I was a teenager. So.
Well, you know, I would definitely recommend Midnight of the Century for my listeners that are either into sort of the post-punk and music culture, or people that are really into politics. As I said, there's some tracks influenced by Orwell and Zizek. I wanted to move on, though. You mentioned Weird Records, which was founded, I believe, by Peter Skolworth, who you mentioned earlier. He was actually in the band Crash Worship. What was Weird Records, and what was its like influence on the music scene in New York?
Yeah, Peter's also currently in Bloody Minded, the Chicago noise band, with Mark Solotroff. Well, I'm obviously biased. But I mean, for me, I would say Peter was in a unique position as somebody who had been, you know, I mean, he'd been around the kind of dark music scene, and he went to CalArts before I met him. I guess it would have been the 90s, and so he was kind of like in, you know, adjacent in the not. I don't think very immersed in the LA scene. I think he was focusing on painting and school and stuff like that. But, you know, Peter had a even at the time he started Weird, I mean, he still does, but a pretty successful career in fine arts, you know, as a painter. So he wasn't your average like promoter or DJ. Peter would, you know, he'll tell anybody, this he stands in front of a canvas, you know, from the time he wakes up till the evening, painting these giant paintings day in, day out. And like for him, he wanted like social interaction and release. So and he loved this music, and, you know, had an interesting group of friends. So Weird kind of just started out as a way to like hang out with your friends and like listen to the music that you like, and have that sort of like social connection that he didn't get from, you know, spending so much time in isolation as a painter, you know? And I think there's seeds there, because I mean, Peter's a smart, smart guy when it comes to philosophy. I mean, we always, vibed on, you know, various being able to discuss various topics. Very first interaction I ever had with him was like a sort of heated argument about whether or not, you know, the brain is meat or is mind and thinks, you know, these kinds of things. You know, even to today, I was actually just at his gallery a couple weeks ago, and his gallerist Miguel Abreu is associated with Sequence Press, who presses all the, you know, a lot of speculative realism, Reza Negrestani. There's always been this thread, you know, but those things kind of began to come together, you know. I don't even think in a conscious way, as sort of culture was evolving, especially internet culture. And I think, for Peter, weird was community, you know, and I think it became increasingly, philosophically tied to the idea of like the body versus abstraction, you know, which is a huge theme in his painting. And I think Weird was successful and memorable in a lot of ways because not necessarily because of its aesthetic, or, you know, which was, I always thought, nicely curated. You know, Peter always like paid attention to all the lights, and just, you know, there's always great music playing and great bands playing. But you know, it was a community, and it really sort of like you read about a lot of like music scenes. You know, I mean, he was the figure around which it really revolved, because he cared about it so much. You know, and so I think that ended up really animating a lot of us who were sort of in the kind of core of this, of the, I don't know what you want to call it, the scene or the label, or, you know, we got together and we sort of collectively wrote the manifesto that was in the second Weird compilation about, you know, the synthesizer as a instrument of resistance. So it became increasingly, there was always I guess what I'm really spending a lot of words to say is, it had a strong underlying reason to be, you know, and that reason was like really great people who wanted to spend time together and collaborate together.
So yeah, that's kind of too. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, no. I mean, the only other thing I was going to say was, like, and then the fact that it was a weekly party with a live band meant that it was a really great place for all of these other bands who were coming up, not just in New York, but elsewhere, to come through and play to a receptive audience. And because Peter wasn't in it to make money, he gave the bands like way more than you would normally get from playing a night like that, because usually the promoters are going to want to, you know, that's how they're trying to pay their rent. But Peter's, you know, making paintings to pay his rent. So he would pay the bands handsomely, and it became like, you know, this great, you know, all the best people were always going to come through, and they were going to want to play Weird on tour, or, you know, they were going to want to do their record release show or play all their new material for the first time at Weird. So, yeah, I think that's another thing that made it unique.
Well, the other interesting thing I find about Weird, and also this also applies to certain other labels and bands within that orbit, for instance, Hospital Records and bands like Cold Cave and Purient, is, you know, it's sort of, it goes against what was becoming like the mainstream hot topic goth culture at the time. And I think Skolworth even has even said that. He felt like, you know, I think he said, we don't use the term goth. And that goth has lost its elegance, sophistication, and most importantly, its pretentiousness. That's a quote that I found of Skolworth. Could you elaborate on that aspect of it, like what it was pushing back against in terms of the sort of goth subculture?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's why, you know, you'll also find people with strong opinions about weird in the positive or negative. And one of the most commonly negative complaints is that it was snobby, right? To me, that's at odds with like what I was just saying about like how, you know, I mean, you want to talk about safe spaces. It was before safe space was a catchword. It was supposed to be this is where weirdos can come be weird. You know, that's why it's called weird. there's that element of the inclusiveness in the community and the sort of like love that was, you know, between a lot of us. And then this notion that we were snobby, but the snobbishness was generally in response to the perception that there were certain things that we were, you know, we weren't going to do. You know, it wasn't going to be a night where you were going to come, like, you know, listen to classic rock. You know what I mean? It was a lot of it was old music, and we obviously love Killing Joke, and we love, you know, Chameleons, and we played all that stuff, but like, the fact that the music was from the 80s, it was still like mostly unheard for everybody who was, you know, coming to the party. So it was that's why the weird, very rare, you know, it wasn't necessarily, it didn't have to be very new, but it had to be very rare. And that's not an invalid thing. You know what I mean? And we would, you know, you'd pepper in your hits, you know, here and there, but it was definitely, I think, in a way, a lot of us, you know, at least me and Peter, I think I can speak for him because I think it's true. But I mean, we had a deep love for a lot of the music that we grew up with, but it's sad to kind of like not want to be associated with it. Because you don't find it, because it's become something that's like no longer eccentric and exciting and strange. It's now, you know, something that's very familiar and packageable and things like that. And yeah, I mean, I guess you could say that down the line, fashion figured out how to follow suit and with what, you know, our scene was doing. And but at the time it was fresh, you know, in its own way. And I think that there was definitely something that appealed to me was this idea that like, oh, we can cultivate this atmosphere of this kind of music that we love, and we can make these records, you know, if we're done with this, you know, if we're a little bit too worn out on these records too, we can make our own. And that's, you know, that's where the original like record label started, you know. It was like Sean from Xenonoka under Marshall Cantrell was making these records, and then played Peter the Blacklist stuff, and he was like, shit, may as well start a record. My friends are making cool shit. So, you know,
Well, yeah, I wanted to interject. You know, I find it interesting that people look at, you know, like Weird Records as having been elitist, just because to me, the real elitism within, you know, all these related scenes, whether we're talking about industrial or goth and post-punk sort of culture, the real elitism is this like mentality that so many of these fans have, that anything after like, you know, a certain period is just not good. You know, it's that old line of like, sure, you know, kids these days with their music. And the musical subcultures do that too, where it's like, anything after Joy Division, can't listen to it. Anything after Skinny Puppy, can't listen to it. Whereas I look at bands like Blacklist, Purient, Cold Cave, you guys are putting a new twist on things. And could you comment on that? Sort of the way people have ignored new music and aren't really celebrating what's coming out there?
I think I'm of two minds about it, because I definitely have always felt like there's and maybe this is just the result of like the time I grew up in and because when I was, you know, kind of in the early 2000s, it was like, I totally date myself to just like to be talking about the internet this way, but it was like your internet connection was so kind of slow and annoying. It was like, yeah, you could find like this cool band from Germany or what this, but such a pain in the ass. It's like you still weren't just in this flow of being able to know everything at every moment. So in my recollection, in my perception, there were ebbs and flows to, you know, for lack of a better term, goth music. You know, there was like, you'd have these moments where there was all these cool bands making cool stuff, and then it would get really corny. You know what I mean? So it seemed to me. I mean, maybe if I went back and looked at, you know, all the things that I love now, there's probably at any given point there was something cool being done. But, you know, I mean, I definitely think though you have the bands that do really well at a given time, and there are a few songs I like, but I don't mind saying that, like, you know, the ascendance of VNV Nation and the sort of music that came with them, you know, it was pretty reasonable to rebel against and just to be like, yeah, this fucking sucks. You know? But on the other hand, you know, for me, I actually got into Purient pretty late in the game. And I got into all the stuff that, you know, hardcore, like old school noise heads weren't as into, which was his kind of, sort of like making industrial records, you know, like the Vatican Shadow stuff and the Bermuda Drain stuff. And for me, that was a new lease on music that I hadn't listened to. You know, I mean, I hadn't felt like somebody had like tapped into a way to make an industrial record that felt, you know, kind of had some flavor that I recognized and loved, but at the same time felt completely like face shreddingly new, you know? So yeah, I mean, I guess I feel like overall, I don't know where I come down on the rebellion against the new in goth and post-punk and industrial. It sometimes feels right on, and then it sometimes feels really annoying, because even by the same token, I'm saying that if I tried to play Purient for, like, you know, certain people play Bermuda Drain, they're just like, what is this? You know, it's right. It's not, it would be way too abrasive and abstract for their taste. So, yeah, I don't know. Sorry, I don't have a better answer.
Well, I think that's a sort of a good way to put where we're at in the culture. There's this like there's this push and pull between, you know, everything has to be retro and wanting to put a new twist on the retro type stuff. I wanted to move into the new school stuff, but real quickly, you know, I wanted to mention your another band, which you have a new album coming out soon. Vara, which, you know, talk about a band that sort of experimented. It's sort of a predecessor of sorts to the whole what people are calling black gaze, you know, that combines shoegaze with black metal. How did Vara come about, though?
I was at a show with Lev Weinstein from Kralis, and he introduced me to Kevin Huffnagel from Dysrhythmia, and who would eventually go on to be in the new incarnation of Gorguts. And it turned out Kevin was like a huge Chameleons fan. And we launched into this conversation about, you know, all these bands that he, you know, was a huge, you know, Field of the Nephilim, 480, all these old 480 bands. So, and, you know, we're talking about some of the metal bands that I liked. And, you know, we were just like, wow. And I was like, dude, you know, would you listen to these demos and see, because I had written these demos for new Blacklist material that they weren't into, because it was, you know, more metal than what they wanted to do. And I think there was a sense that, like, oh, this is your thing, you know, you're into this stuff, not us, which is a natural enough feeling. I don't begrudge it, but I was like, well, this is the music I want to make. Kevin dug it, and yeah, that's really just how it started. And it's often been one of those things where, like, people will listen to the records and they'll be like, oh, that post-punk song, that sounds, you know, it must be Josh's song, and the metal song must be Kevin's, when it's the exact opposite. It was like Kevin's outlet to make post-punk stuff, and it's like my outlet to do more metal stuff. And usually the heavier stuff was my doing, and the more post-punk stuff was his. So it was really just we really got along really well and had a ton of overlap musically, and he dug the songs that I'd written. And then I was working, you know, Charlie was in Religious the Dam, which was the earliest incarnation of Azar Swan, and he was an incredible drummer. And he had said to me, you know, if you ever do a metal band, can I play drums? And I was like, hell yeah. So once Kevin and I were making music, I just brought Charlie on naturally. And then Toby, I mean, Kevin was friends with Toby, and he was like, because what Toby was doing, and even Toby's sensibilities in a lot of ways, I think he thought would match well with the band. And I think he was right, you know, because KO Dot's been gradually, I mean, I think Toby even sometimes maybe somewhat laughingly refers to it as avant-garde, you know? And it's just a really great, I've never had a personal and creative dynamic as good as that, as those four people, us four. So that's where it came from.
Well, what interests me about Vara is, you know, I'm a big proponent of metal, but what annoys me about a lot of people I've known in the metal scene is a lot of people only want to use the genre for, like, headbanging. You know, it's like Slayer or die. And I think there's right. a lot more that can be done with that sort of heavy sound
exactly.
than just headbanging. I mean, we see it with bands like the Angelic Process. And like I said, Vara, there's so much experimentation and so many moods that you can create with that heavy sort of metal sound.
Right, right. Yeah, and in some ways that was a natural – that's why to me it was a natural progression from what we were doing with Blacklist. I was like, you know, because it was always like, let's make this thing heavier, you know, like sonically speaking, you know. So, and I think I've said somewhere that to me it was like, it was before there was all this talk about, like, you know, kind of getting all the racist machismo out of metal. I was like, this is about the, like, almost like the feminine side, you know, my own. It's like, when I try, it's absurd. It's like, I have a natural sort of like core of sort of like femininity that I think comes that it's in how I present myself, and it's in how I write music, you know? And, I think for me, Vara was always this almost like, you know, injecting like the feminine into something that had traditionally just been like, you know, eat your head off kind of like thrash, you know. And I don't know if I'm allowed that in terms of today's politics and whether or not that's overstepping my bounds. But to me, it's natural. You know what I mean? So. And I think it's both natural and it's like, I guess it's natural to me because I see it in my own limitations. Because I think even at the time I was starting to make the music, I was trying to find that aspect of myself, you know, this like really, you know, I was really angry. I was going through a bad time and I would make these songs and I'd just be like, nope, that's still pretty, still pretty romantic sounding. So just somewhere, it's just in there. So
can I comment on that real quick? I was gonna sure. say it reminds me a lot of you know, Justin Broderick from Godflesh. You know, he makes all this like angry music under the Godflesh banner, and then
I was in the bar with him at Hospital Fest last week.
Oh really? That's cool. But he goes from doing that to the band Yesu, which is like it's another band that I think has that sort of feminine aspect to it, and I think it just, like, completely took people off guard. There's a similar trajectory there.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I think it's also part of something that made me gravitate towards metal in the first place, because, you know, I'm not ashamed to say, and I've told it to him to his face, because we're friends. We've gone on a short tour together, and we see each other at festivals now and again. But Alcest, you know, Nej Stefan from Alcest, the way that he was sort of like these like really heavy sort of tremolo picked guitars, but then these like really dreamy falsetto vocals, you know, over top, like was totally appealing to me.
And I guess your most recent musical project is Azar Swan. If you want to tell my listeners a little bit about that, in case they're unfamiliar, it's sort of a musical duo.
We had a band called Religious Saddam, which was kind of like around the same time as Blacklist, and at the time I was the singer. Zora and I were a couple. And she was writing her own songs, and you know, I was kind of like helping her flesh them out a bit, and just kind of ended up in the band. And that's when we found Charlie. It was kind of a chamber. We had like Zora would play like harmonium. She's Afghan. She'd play harmonium and auto harp and guitar and acoustic guitar, and then we had a cellist, and so it was like, people called it like chamber goth or something, or chamber on whatever. We found that really, really difficult to bring to the clubs we were playing in New York. It's like, if you want to bring all those kinds of instruments, it's like, you can't bring them to the Annex, which was, just one of the clubs in the Lower East Side that was popular at the time. So we decided to reinvent things electronically. Actually, Zora taught her how to use DAW, you know, like a GarageBand sort of thing. And her writing changed. She started using all these kind of synth pads, and I dug it a lot. And I was actually listening to a lot of hip hop at the time, and I wanted to kind of explore production along those lines, partially. In a way, I was around all these, you know, hardware synth cold wave virtuosos, you know. I was like, I have no experience with this machinery, and like technical, the gear end of music really like fucks my process up. If I have to like, I need to be able to just like hear the thing and make the thing, you know. Or at least at the time I did. I'm more into like discovering things as I stuck with an instrument now, especially synths, but then I was kind of like, almost as a way to not only explore the stuff I was into, but as a way to kind of do something different than all the people that we were around, I just kind of approached the production a different way. And it gradually became more and more quote unquote industrial. It's like, I would kind of, these little things from my past that once I was getting better at using the, you know, finding my way around the synths and things like that, I'd set out to do something that was maybe influenced by something I'd heard on the radio, and then I'd be like, it kind of sounds like Frontline Assembly, you know. We've gradually gotten, I think, a little, we both had a pretty bad year the last 2 years. And the record we made was really harsh and bleak. And we worked with Chris Lapke, who does a lot of stuff with Korean Hospital Productions and Cold Cave. And he kind of like brought his production magic to it. And you know, so we've gone from being this like kind of like Kate Bush. A lot of people compared it to Kate Bush and the Knife, like pop electronic music, to kind of grim, bleak, post-industrial.
Is that Savage Exile, the album?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very it has a lot of aggression and sort of a cold sort of aesthetic to it. It's a pretty powerful album.
Oh, thank you. I still very, very happy with it. The way it came, it was very hard to put it together, but once it was done, I'm pretty excited about it.
And I guess
also cool because it's one of the first records where the writing process was almost like bifurcated. Like a lot of times with other stuff, Zorro would like write a demo and bring it to me, and then I kind of like mess with, you know, change, put my spin on the beat and like, you know, maybe add a bridge here or a new little melody there. It was more collaborative. Like she was the primary songwriter, wrote the core of the song, vocals, lyrics, and I would just kind of produce and write, you know, flourishes here and there. But Savage Exile was like almost like the Dead Can Dance record where it's all Brendan Perry on one side and all Lisa Gerrard on the other side. Like she would bring songs. I was just like, this is brilliant. Nothing for me to do on this. And she, you know, she got into these like really brutal kind of Diamanda sounding vocals. And it was an interesting record to make.
Well, I was going to say too, Atash has a very interesting background herself as a child of Afghan refugees, I believe. And also, someone who's experienced things like a synesthesia, I think it's called, and hallucinations,
right.
Sleep disorders. So she has an interesting background that I think really comes through in the music itself.
For sure, yes. I think it's I love when people hear that. For sure.
And
mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
No, I think, you know, she's even gone into a lot of detail about, you know, just like, you know, listening to her dad's monkey's records and, you know, just there always being music around the house because her dad, you know, they would just have these family get-togethers and, you know, eat a bunch of food and, you know, get to sit around in a circle and like play music, play tabla and rubab and sing I think it's all very... comes from the deep for her, for sure.
Well, I would definitely recommend checking out Azar Swan. And, you know, I know we talked about this, if you have time to discuss it, how you got involved in the New School. For my listeners that don't know, could you tell us what the New School is?
Yeah, it's, there's the New School and there's the New School for Social Research, but it was actually founded by John Dewey. According to his, you know, kind of educational philosophy, but it came to be known as University in Exile because a lot of Frankfurt School intellectuals found a home there after coming over from the war. And you know, so the critical theory tradition is definitely like very much alive there. It's the type of place where, you know, your teacher's like, hey, you know, if you guys want to go see Habermas speak downstairs, you get class credit, or you want to go see Kristeva speak downstairs, you get class, you know. So it's like, it's really probably one of the biggest kind of schools for that. And I was, at the time, I really wanted to study, I wasn't even thinking about music that much at the time, but I was really into Zizek, and I didn't understand Zizek, and I was like, okay, in order to understand Zizek, I'm going to have to, like, you know, read Marx and Lacan and all this stuff. And I was like, the only place you can really get into psychoanalysis is New York. And, you know, people were telling me about the type of guests, you know, the teachers and the guest speakers that they would have. And I was like, that's obviously the place I need to go. So, that was what I ended up there. But it was a very interesting process being there, because I definitely didn't leave having done any of the things that I thought I had gone there to do. Just in a very cliche intellectual journey kind of way. I mean, I did, you know, spend plenty of time with continental philosophy and, you know, post-structuralist, post-modernist, Zizekian analyses, you know, wrote papers about Kafka, like through the lens of Lacan. They did all that stuff. But by the time I left, I was preoccupied with a whole different set of concerns and approaches, I think.
Well, you've talked about this before. At the New School, one of the pivotal things that happened for you there is you're meeting with probably the most famous of the new atheists, and this is the moment everyone's been waiting to hear about, is your sort of experiences with Christopher Hitchens.
Yeah, no, a friend of mine. I knew of Hitchens through, I knew him at that time as Trial of Henry Kissinger Hitchens, you know. He'd written some great stuff in Harper's, you know, bringing Kissinger to task for war crimes. And a friend of mine knew that I was at the New School and knew that I liked Hitchens. And he was like, "Hey, do you know he teaches there?" And I was like, "No." "Cool, I'll go take his class." So it was really all about that simple. And I found him to be, it's tough when it's, and it's kind of interesting too, when somebody's perceived as this kind of like the kind of figure that he is.
Very rambunctious, always wanting a debate, always arguing. Yeah. That image.
Or even just influential and a bit of a celebrity, you know, it's like, kind of, it has been fraught for me throughout the years to discuss it, because people are always like, you know, "Oh, you're a fanboy, you're an acolyte, you know, this kind of stuff." And it's like you don't understand this guy. You know what I mean? It was like he was very kind to his students and very generous with his time and his knowledge, and he was a charming guy. But like, if you ended up like vibing together, it was just because you did, you know, it was just because you had like a similarity of spirit, you know. Like, he was not the type of person to keep fanboys at his heels, you know. And in true to some of his most famous declarations, it was like you spent most of your time arguing with him. I've argued with him about numerous things, abortion, you know, Buddhism, what you name it. And it's, you know, that was what you did, and drank scotch, you know, smoked cigarettes. So,
I think people know. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I mean, there's a million kind of angles to come at this from. Like, one of the most notable to me, I guess, is that I've found it interesting in my capacity as somebody who's been, you know, adjacent to people like him, just kind of in the shadows, to sort of see how they're perceived and written and remembered and distorted. Not only in the time he was alive, but I mean, great, insanely since he's been dead. It's something that you can't without having seen it go down, like, and sort of just because there's no empirical way to just be like, okay, I can prove that he was this way and believe this. I mean, you could cite his work or whatever, but you know, people are more or less going to just be like, it's your subjective, you know, you spend this time with this person, you know, their thought, you know, their work. And then you kind of see how radically they can be misrepresented by people who would have really liked him and agreed with him way more than they think they ever would have. So there's been a lot of interesting takeaways from that relationship, which was admittedly brief. I mean, we only knew each other for a couple of years before he passed, and he didn't live in town. We exchange emails, catch up after a lecture for, you know, drink whenever possible. But I look forward, and I've almost written the notes myself for maybe like a kind of journalistic reconsideration, you know, people always write these pieces around his death. You know, there's stuff recently about his falling out with Gore Vidal and, you know, what would Hitch have thought of this? And, but I think that there's a really, I think there's a more interesting, case to be made for like how his shadow sort of looms over the current political landscape. Maybe I'll get around to writing it one of these days.
Well, I know, we talked in a previous conversation a little bit about, you know, two things that I think people associate Hitchens with that you had opinions that were, I would say, contradicting the sort of mainstream narrative about Hitchens since his passing. And that's mainly like sort of there's this mentality that Hitchens is sort of this just a simple masculinist kind of guy that was like, you know, in some ways, like, I think people portray him as like the macho version of a debater. Like, he, you know, the idea of like Christopher Hitchens destroys X and that's all that there is to
right.
Hitchens in a lot of people's eyes. Could you comment on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, Hitchens is like, you don't have to dig very deeply to find like almost outright expressions of homoerotic feeling for Martin Amis during the time they were in France together. His like some, you know, there's a clip somewhere that like defense of his, you know, his defense of Stephen Fry at some sort of debate and about, of homosexual love, is a far more, you know, and I think if people, he's harsh, but, you know, but slick when he's, you know, doing his debate, his, what people now stupidly call hitch slap, you know, but he's not a very macho guy. Like if you just kind of step back, and it's especially in, you know, more so in person. I mean, there's a strain of the feminine and of the homoerotic that is, or the non, whatever, just that runs strongly against the sort of like cishet white male piece of shit kind of view of him. And that's not to say that people who sort of look at what he said about like why women aren't funny and some of his remarks, I mean, are shitty. Like they're not really defensible and I wouldn't try to defend them. But I would have argued with him about them, you know, had they come up, and then that was always on offer, you know what I mean? And he's a person whose mind can be changed. And I know these are the kinds of like platitudes that like some of the worst people on the internet start throwing around, and, you know, I'm throwing them around in defense of one of their favorite people to hate, but, yeah.
Well, I think the interesting thing, about Hitchens, with regards to what you're talking about is, you know, there is that sort of feminine aspect, that you can sort of see in regards to, he could be very dramatic in his pronouncements, even flamboyant at times. I mean, he wrote a book called The Trial of Henry Kissinger. You know, he sort of has that, you know, just a sort of flamboyant sort of style and a sort of dramatic flair to his mm-hmm. approach.
Right. Which I think, I would almost say that I think part of that, though, is what feels like drama is his kind of like endless war on cliche and ability to like turn a phrase that like sort of has a lot of you know, what's the word I want? It just has a lot of power, but that doesn't feel it. It's like you feel like there's this intensity and this violence and this drama, but it's actually wit and it's actually newness and it's actually the fact that you're hearing a point made so eloquently and acerbically that it kind of has this, it hits you on this level, you know what I mean? Because that's the power of not being cliche. and of making it your sort of like life practice to not even speak in cliches, you know? I don't know. That's one way of, I think, of sort of framing his dramatics.
Yeah, he was a very literary minded person, as opposed to you know, the other new atheists really came from a very different background. I mean, Sam Harris, neuroscience, you know, Dawkins, biology. They all came from different backgrounds. Hitchens was more the guy that came from a literary end of things. So I think there's a lot to what you're saying there. And I also think the Hitch slap
is kind of... Well, he always said
he
wanted to write about literature, but politics always got in the way. I mean, that was his love, you know?
Well, yeah, not only that, but, you know, people talk about the Hitch slap now, but no one does it with the sort of playfulness that Hitchens would do it. You know, Hitchens is sort of like when he's debating someone that's an idiot, he's sort of, you know, toying with them like a cat would toy with a ball of yarn. Whereas, like, sure, you know, these people that are like facts and logic bros like Ben Shapiro, they just can't hold a candle to that. They're just these angry little men.
Which is why it's so annoying to sort of hear them try to claim him as their saint, and, you know, claim that he would have been on their side politically. It's like, no, you're the person who's fetishized Hitchens, because, like, you know, as I think I might have said when we spoke before, I mean, Hitchens is a guy who said, like, swastika exists for one reason, to be defaced, and he believed in getting in street fights with fascists, which he did in a famous incident. The idea that Hitchens would be out there, like, you know, like cheering on Ben Shapiro's side, he's like, he would have seen this current political moment for what it is. And that, I believe. And I think people would be, those nerds would be completely shocked if they had to hear what he'd actually think.
Well, I think too, the other thing I have to ask about is, I'm assuming there were probably students that tried to, you know, heckle him about his initial support of the Iraq War. Do you have any recollections of things like that happening?
Well, not specifically of the Iraq War, but, like, in our class, there were definitely students who, you know, you could perceive, like, there was a palpable kind of, like, disdain, for him, and this sort of, like, you know, I'm gonna, you know, they had a knee-jerk, funnily enough, contrarianism to him, and I wouldn't say it ever manifested in debates about the Iraq War, but that was the clear subtext at the time. I mean, it was like 2006 or something, I think, or maybe it was a little bit later than that, but the, you know, the great, you know, a lot of the students at the new school are very left-leaning, and I think to them, you know, this person who was, like, increasingly being known as, like, a neocon, you know, Trotskyite turncoat of the left, like, they were ready to kind of go in, and his sort of the scope of his not only understanding of Marxism and the left historically and in terms of and philosophically was so overwhelming, and his genuine I think even passion for it still. I mean, I don't think he ever lost the passion for it, for those principles, would always end up kind of winning the day and kind of winning them over. You know, it's kind of fun to see, I think. And I think that also informs why the way I see not only the way he's, you know, venerated by these right wing turds, but the way he's hated by so much of the left. I'm like, yeah, I don't know. There's some accounting needs to be done one of these days, and it'll be, I'm sure somebody will do it. If they don't, I will. But yeah, there was definitely I saw interactions like that.
Well, do you think Hitchens truly ever exited the left or left the left, or do you think there was still that sort of spark? Would he make arguments that were like out-Marxing the Marxists at times?
Totally. I mean, I would say, I think something that's kind of brutal about journalism and about making your living as a journalist, and I've seen it in some friends of mine who have, you know, had to try to figure out how to make a career. And when you're trying to make a career as a political journalist, it gets even tougher because political sides are sort of confused by sociology. You know, they're confused by the social element. And I think there's at any given point, there are dominant orthodoxies within a political party or side of the aisle that are conflicting, you know?
Yeah, there are social forces at work, in other words.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So if, for instance, like the way that Hitchens sort of like singled out, you know, Islamic theocracy as something he had something to say about, which was more or less consistent with his, you know, he saw it as consistent with his background, you know, as consistent with his views about secularism, you know, for instance, he, you know, always famously was like, you know, I'm on the side of the Kurdish Marxists, you know what I mean? I think it can become tough, and I've even sort of like, because there was a time where I was writing for publication, but I was also doing music, and there's a huge problem where if you want to look for the interesting thing to say, right? You want to look for the thing that's gonna sort of break people's brains open a little bit, and you know you could because you and that's, you know, if you're in the best case scenario, you're doing that because that's sort of what you thrive on yourself. You love that moment where like something, a light goes on or something changes in the way that you saw something. And then you kind of like look for those things. But when you're dealing with like ideological incentives in journalism, and now even more so with the economic incentives of the social internet, it makes being that way extremely costly. And I think he's kind of like a really, to me, one of the ways that I would frame his quote unquote conversion or turn to the right, as some people call it, is in those terms. It's as an early sort of like harbinger of things that were to come and become even more intensified. Because, you know, I mean, it's sort of incredible to listen to people characterize him as, you know, a conservative or right winger based on the things they know about his support for the Iraq War or his Why Women Aren't Funny article, you know, and these are really what people know. And then to go listen to him talk for, you know, an hour or two about what his issues are with religion, which in almost every case is because it offends his very liberal left sensibilities.
Well, I was going to say, this is a bit speculative, right? And I'm just curious. So you've seen how the new atheist movement has sort of changed over the years. I mean, now we have people like Sam Harris being supportive of, you know, these right-wing YouTube personalities like Sargon of Akkad. Richard Dawkins is talking about how we need to support Christianity because Islam will take over Europe if we don't. What do you think Hitchens would have made of all of this? And do you think Hitchens would have gone as far as Dawkins and Harris have in their sort of like complete condemnations of – I mean, I think they go beyond critiquing Islam. I think they just are actually Islamophobic.
Right. I mean, I think again, I think kind of almost in as a perfect follow-up to what we were talking about as far as like the sociological dimension, the social dimension of like political inconsistency versus consistency and trying to be a public person talking about things like that. I think it's been interesting to watch those guys change over the years because I think it's really kind of a clear cut to me, the case of like their sense of embattlement and sort of almost rote thinking of it. Well, if this person thinks that I'm wrong about this, I must be right. You know, I think has really clouded their ability to sort of like think straight. For people who are like super into thinking straight, it's like, you know, do I think, I mean, I always saw Hitch as, you know, when you know, the Sarah Palin moment happened, and he's just like, fuck no, I'm not on board with, you know, it's like, I think he had the I don't think he would have gone there. Let's say that much. I mean, because like I said, I mean, I think one of the things about Hitchens' critique of foreign policy, right, would be he came from a tradition of anti-U.S. imperialism, and he believed in that strongly. But he had, like, compared to, like, the average leftist anti-imperialist that you speak to today, he had his scope of knowledge of other tyrannies, other imperialisms, was so vast that he could weigh it and he could say, well, okay, not into U.S. imperialism. Well, how do I feel about Russian, you know, like Russian oligarchical imperialism? Like, you know, I think he would have been the type of person who would have seen the scope of the rightward turn of the world right now towards authoritarianism and fascism. Because ultimately, the core of everything, whether it's his, and we can get into like his missteps as far as his support for the Iraq war, or some of the things he said about Islam, but it's all anti-authoritarianism, anti-fascism, anti-totalitarianism, you know? And that animated him to such an extent that I don't think he would have been carried away the way some of these guys have been carried away by their detractors, you know? I think he would have been really angry.
Well, not only that, but go ahead, sorry.
To see, you know, America's like flirtations with, you know, with the far right and with, you know, right-wing authoritarianism, Europe's turned to the right, you know, I don't think that would have been lost on him. And I think he would, at the time, you know, at the time that people like, I've always said this, like at the time that Sam Harris was saying, you know, well, who are the people who are blowing themselves up in the name of God right now? Who are the people who are doing, and at the time it felt maybe accurate, right? This is a problem we need to address. This seems unique, right? But like, you could never look at the world right now and say this is the big problem. You know what I mean? And I can't say for sure, but I don't think Hitchens would have continued down that path either, nor ever made accommodations with like we need to be Christian for. I mean, it was too deeply revolting to him I haven't even heard that Dawkins thing about like alliance with Christianity against Islam, but it's one of those things. It's I mean, I'm a small enough drop in a big enough pond to be able to like, probably get away with saying this, but I've had private conversations with the guy where he's talked about, I mean, they were obviously outwardly allies and they were friends, those four guys, but like he knew when they were full of shit. on certain issues and would say so in private. So, and probably to their face had they argued about it, but you know, there was not a really a dogmatic boys club when it came to that.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because like sometimes I listen to Sam Harris and what he has to say about Buddhism, and I'm like, this guy doesn't know what the hell he's talking about.
I don't know that I've seen him talk about Buddhism in a while. I pay attention to his podcast almost the way I pay attention to Bill Maher's show, just because of what he curates, just so I can listen to different people like talk and, you know, decide what I think of Charles Murray or fucking whoever he might have on most recently. But, you know, yeah, I saw the thing about him, like, principal, you know, exit from Patreon. I'm just like, Jesus Christ, man, this guy's really, really lost it. Whatever he had.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think, too, you know, I think people like Joe Rogan and Sam Harris may not even believe everything they say, but they know who their audience is, and they're driven by that social force. They know they have a lot of these alt-light and alt-right people that listen to them, so they're going to cater to them. And, you know, the thing about Hitchens is, Hitchens may have been a neocon, but he subjected himself to waterboarding. And he said, after having it done to him, he said, it's torture.
Right.
He changed his mind. I don't put Hitchens in the same category as the Sam Harris's of the world, in other words.
No, because they were different. They were definitely different. And, if you look at somebody like Sam Harris's career trajectory, I mean, I think at the time he wrote End of Faith, he just like basically graduated with a philosophy degree, you know? I mean, he didn't come to it from neuroscience. He wrote End of Faith and then went and got his neuroscience PhD, which makes sense to me because neuroscience was a huge interest to me when I was in school, because it's a very, very powerful rebuttal to a lot of like religious worldviews. Not only really, I mean, all kinds of superstition. I mean, even fucking OTO and the will, you know, I mean, I wrote my paper on the neuroanatomy of free will. It's like, it's hard for me to like sit around with like, you know, Crowley and, you know, do what thou wilt. I'm like, well, let's talk about the wilt, you know? You know, I mean, Dawkins and Dennett were definitely more, you know, came from a stronger background, but I mean, Hitchens was, to me, the prong of New Atheism that he was the idea that, you know, the connection between religion and political oppression, it could not too soon be forgotten. You know what I mean? And I think that was so in kind of ran through everything that he'd ever done, that I have a hard time picturing him having strayed from that, especially for social or, you know, audience reasons. Like, you know, like if he wanted to go where his audience was, he would have just become the new Noam Chomsky, which I sort of feel like he was poised to become. I mean, when I was like a hardcore, I mean, I'm still, I think, pretty far to the left, but I mean, when I was like hardcore, you know, brand new, enthusiastic, like young leftist, like Noam Chomsky was the guy, you know, that was actually kind of almost like a leader to the left. Everybody looked to him. And there's almost a feeling like Hitch might be the next, you know, the next guy. And then September 11th happened, and obviously that whole vibe changed, but
Well, yeah, it's been a crazy, crazy road for a lot of public intellectual figures. And you know, whatever people want to say about Christopher Hitchens, he knew how to start a fire in the intellectual discourse and the public discourse.
All right. Well, I mean, what I was going to say, my brain got sidetracked, but what I was going to say is that had he wanted to just follow his audience, he could have just kept doing the nation anti-U.S. imperialism thing. But, I mean, there was no calculation like, this is going to be great for me to lose all my friends and be, you know, remembered as a pariah. He did it because he believed in it, which is funny because a lot of people have obviously made the critique that he loved power, you know, that he got all this, you know, money from right-wing people to say what he said is bullshit, you know. People always make that shit up. But
well, I want to start wrapping up. I know I've kept you pretty long here, and I appreciate that. I wanted to ask, though, what's that?
I said I love talking about this stuff.
Well, I'm glad about that.
All the things I'm constantly trying to keep myself from saying on social media. Like, I'm recording here for you to put on the internet for everyone.
Well, I guess the thing I wanted to close out on, it was actually two things. You know, just to humanize old Hitch a bit, do you have any, you know, personal anecdotes or recollections that stick out in your mind to show sort of the more human side as opposed to the you know, angry debater that would destroy the enemy?
Yeah. So Zora came, my current bandmate, Azar Swan, then girlfriend, came to meet us. He was kind of, I forget if it was after a class or after a debate or what. It was kind of a thing. A bunch of folks were going to Uptown French Roast for dinner, and she showed up. So, you know, and I think this is, for me, this is very much in the perfect contrast, the perfect illustration of everything we've just been talking about. Because there were definitely, like, sort of adoring Hitchens fans around, people who were just kind of fawning and wanting his ear and wanted to talk, you know, talk to him about this or that. And my, you know, unassuming Muslim girlfriend comes, sits down, and he paid her the most sort of not like it wasn't like, oh, this is, you know, this is my girlfriend, she's a Muslim, like, you know, and then he's like ultra nice to her just to prove, you know, it was just he wanted to engage her the most and ask her questions about her background, and he was like asked questions and listened and was just very, very sweet. While all these other people kind of wanted to, you know, a slice of his celebrity, he wanted to hear from this, you know, complete stranger about, you know, her life growing up as an Afghan refugee and all this stuff, you know. So not very sexist, not very Islamophobic in my experience. I that's probably one of my sweetest memories of him. And I think Zora remembers it similarly, as him having been very warm and kind.
Well, I think that's a great note to end on with regards to Christopher Hitchens. Last thing I want to ask, though, is, you know, you have a new Vara album coming out. Maybe one day we'll get Midnight of the Century Part 2. And, of course, you were at Hospital Fest. Just if you could give us sort of some closing thoughts on the musical direction you're going in, where you see the music scene, maybe your experience at Hospital Fest, just to end on a positive note.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, Hospital Fest was amazing. It was a really, really great time. Since the demise of Weird, I've definitely felt like Hospital has been kind of a community that I feel at home with, and that has sort of like been generous to Zora and I. And, you know, Zora DJed for like the first 6 hours of the fest. We had a blast and tons of great music, but also just tons of great friends, you know, some in from out of town, some I hadn't seen in a long time because I live in New Orleans now. So it's very cool. Yeah, the Blacklist record turns 10 years old next year. So we're talking to each other. I won't say about what, but we've all been in communication for the first time in many, many years. So we'll see what comes of that. And as far as musical direction, I was really thrilled to get to work with one of my kind of like lifetime heroes musically on this new record, which is, his name's Peter Walsh. He's a producer. I always remembered seeing his name on records that I loved, like The Church's Heyday and Zymox Twist of Shadows, Simple Minds, New Gold Dream, all these records. And then I got, you know, discovered Scott Walker's later records, you know, Climate of Hunter and Tilt. And those became really, really some of my probably still some of my very favorite music that's ever been made. And I keep seeing, I was like, Peter Walsh. And then I realized they were the same guy. So he mixed the Nuvara record, and it was an honor to work with him. And I actually got to meet him when I was in New York recently, and he's a lovely person, and I would love to make another record with him one of these days. And yeah, I mean, there's definitely new music on the horizon. I think there's some Azar Swan material in the pipeline that's even more aggressive than the last record and also more upbeat. So I think there's probably going to be two releases, probably do the noisy one low key first, and then probably have a pretty, like, probably one of our more upbeat records since the second one after that. And I'm already hatching plans for the fourth Vara record, but I'm probably going to keep them a secret.
Fair enough.
They're probably going to change, but suffice to say, if you like what we're doing on this new record, you'll probably like where it's going after that, I hope.
Well, Joshua Strawn, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views.
Thanks, man. Really, really nice talking to you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Joshua Strawn of such musical projects as Blacklist, Vara, and Azar Swan. As a little bit of a side note, I forgot to mention it in the intro, that conversation you just heard was previously unpublished and saved from the Parallax Views archives. With that in mind, I encourage you to check out the newest Azar Swan album, The Hissing of a Paper Crane, which recently gained some attention from the Recording Academy. Yes, the organization behind the Grammy Awards. It is by far the most experimental and noisiest of Azar Swan's output thus far. So, if you're interested in hearing that and Azar Swan's other music, head over to Azar Swan, that's azarswan.bandcamp.com. If you enjoyed this edition of Parallax Views, drop me a line on Twitter at viewsparallax, or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. And also, if you can, please help support the show on Patreon, where we release the Parallax Views current events program the week that was. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.
I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.